I'd like now to welcome Talaysha Palin. She is an associate professor of computer science at the University of Colorado Boulder, and she's the director of Project EPIC. EPIC stands for Empowering the Public with Information in Crisis. She's part of the Human-Centered Computing Area at the University of Colorado Boulder, and she will be giving a talk titled How Social Media Might Help You Survive the Next Big Disaster, sponsored by the Santa Fe Institute. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So you are involved in a new kind of interdisciplinary research, and I think your work is so interesting because it's a lot of stuff that's never been done before, and the methods are new. You're evolving them as you go along. It's called crisis informatics. What's that all about?
So crisis informatics was born out of an observation I made in 2005 coming from an existing field of research that I had been working in for a long time called computer-mediated communication and computer-supported cooperative work, that it would seem that with the pervasive technology that we had available to us at the time, and then recall that in the U.S. we weren't using texting even very much. It was adopted a bit more broadly overseas, but not very much in the U.S., but it seemed that the sign of the times with the deployment of mobile phones to virtually everyone and the improvements in network technology that we were going to see some interesting things happen as soon as there was something interesting that happened out in the world. And so when we look at disasters, we are looking at social convergence of people and of resources and of ideas. And when you look at the massive distribution of technology, it seemed like these were two things that would match up in terms of people innovating during events where they were needing to coordinate with each other, needing to solve problems, and this kind of thing. And so the work was born out of those early ideas. And unfortunately, very tragically, Katrina, Hurricane Katrina, and then Rita, its immediate follow-on, very quickly demonstrated that those ideas were going to be something we needed to be able to lean on very heavily. And so since that time, my group has grown. I've grown in collaboration with others. We've graduated students who have specialized in this area of looking at social computing methods, that is the examination of big data, looking at it both quantitatively and then diving in very critically and looking at it almost ethnographically to understand not just who is speaking to whom online, but what they're doing and why are they doing it and what does the nature of that work in the case of work, when it becomes something that people accomplish, products that they create in response to problems that they see in disaster, what does that look like?
Products they create?
Right. So we became very interested in the public participation aspect of technology in disaster response. And so before all of this, there had been a fair amount of research done on new ICT, new IT for emergency management as a formal response.
ICT, information
communication technology. But looking at largely closed systems that would help emergency managers, first responders, and aid workers do their jobs better, which is great. We need to keep having that. But the rise of mobile technology and then social media not long after that put new attention or renewed attention on the role of the members of the public in disaster response.
Well, one of the things that's so interesting about this is that as you write in some of your work, a lot of your first responders are actually the disaster victims
that's
themselves.
Right. Yes. That's right. That's right. And this is based on observations of, you know, the 100 years or so of research we've had on the sociology of disaster, where that research has really called to attention the role of members of the public, because without them, we wouldn't have the kind of immediate response that we have. And so they are the ones who rescue people from the rubble because they know the layout of the land. They are in the city, in the area that is affected, say, for example, by an earthquake, whereas it takes some time for groups to come in and perform rescue.
They know who their most vulnerable neighbors
exactly,
are.
Exactly. They bring people to hospitals because in a disaster is a disaster when the resources of a city or a region or larger are compromised and there aren't enough emergency medical services, for example, to go around. And so you have people transporting each other to hospitals. I mean, this becomes the definition of a disaster. And without that help, we wouldn't actually have the kind of response that we do have. We depend on members of the public for very critical functions. So it goes beyond the sort of the very nice things that people might do later on, which is to have food lines and raise money and all those things, also very important. But it goes, their work goes to the very critical aspects of emergency response. And sometimes we don't quite appreciate when we think about emergency management policy, we forget in our planning stages how critical it is to not think of the members of the public as people to just police. They are active participants and critical participants in the work of emergency response.
And so when you have suddenly cell phones, internet, and all kinds of communications, what kinds of response systems emerge in the first 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 2 hours of a disaster, whether it be, well, 9/11, that was, as you say, sort of before texting and all of that, but in, say, Hurricane Katrina or in Hurricane Sandy in New York mm-hmm. recently.
So I think there's some commonalities. I think the behaviors are changing and growing as people become more experienced and more fluent with social media. But you also see some differences depending on the kind of event that people are encountering. So, for example, earthquake detection. Some of the very immediate things you see on Twitter and online during an earthquake is that people are sensing an earthquake, and their posts actually follow very closely exactly what those earthquake, the intensity, the feelings of intensity are. For events that are protracted, for which we might have warning, you see different kinds of behaviors emerge before the event. People trying to figure out what to do, trying to understand the true risk that might affect them, what they would do if they decide that the risk is going to reach a certain threshold. Increasingly, we're seeing some, we've seen this for a while, but we're seeing even more of it. We're seeing some behaviors that I think are creative and surprising. We see people who are finding bits of information from one part of the net or one part of the Twitterverse, if I can call it that, and they're finding information elsewhere and then putting it together and adding something new to the information space. So, like, for example, one of the things that we've written about in the Twitter activities in the midst of the 2009 Red River floods that affected North Dakota and up into Canada, the USGS made a data table available that showed flood levels at different points along the river. And somebody created a little tweet bot and botted out those different levels. And yet another person who was a pilot, seemed to be a private pilot, located elsewhere, I think he was in Florida, well outside the area, has some experience reading topographical maps. And so he said, well, you know, I'm looking at the topography of the region. I see this USGS data, flood data information. He said, I kind of predict this is might be where the most dangerous spots might be along this river. And this was just all done kind of as an improvised way of adding value to the space, probably based on a recognition that this exists. This data exists. I have this resource. Here's what I can offer.
And it's such a striking example of what happens when you don't just rely on the authorities, but you have, I don't know what it's called, crowdsourcing or the kind of wiki everybody participates. You get something probably more powerful and certainly in moments like that more effective than if you were relying on specialists.
I think what we see and what I hope to see in the future is a convergence of the kind of information we get by crowdsourcing or crowd work, either opportunistically or by design, and that information that we get from authorities and agencies. There really is an opportunity for these things to come together. When we write about past events, in 2007, 8, 9, 10 even, we don't see a lot of agencies online tweeting and posting. Since 2010, I think we've seen some changes there, and so now the questions are a little bit different about how you synthesize those pieces of information together. But these stories we told, the illustrations that we called out in the late 2000s were done in absence of there being much authoritative information online, right? And so you see this, so to say, I hesitate to say it's more valuable than what authorities put out. It was just moving ahead of what what they were able to do at the time. And so we use those as an opportunities to say, this is the kind of information genesis, the kind of information synthesis that can happen when you look at it at large among a community of people. I think now the questions are changing. We can think about, now we know, for example, when agencies do have a Twitter presence online, they are among the most retweeted accounts. People want seek that information out as well, and they move it around. So there really is a necessary place in this information ecology, if we can call it that, for authoritative information, no matter where it comes from.
We're talking to computer scientist Laysha Palin about the role of social media in disaster response. So we're talking about how social media work in a disaster, and you've got authoritative information, you've got information that is put out by people who are in an area who know more because they're already on the ground mm-hmm. when this disaster hits, whether it be an earthquake or a storm or whatever. And there is the question of whether people trust the authorities. Mm-hmm. So if, like, for example, when there is a mandatory evacuation, there's always people who don't evacuate. How do you think about that? How do you deal with it? How do the technologies that you're working with help you to understand and work with all of that?
Okay, that's a great question. So I think the first thing to know or to understand is that it's always been this way. There's always some who resist evacuation, either because, you know, they don't want to leave their homes, they feel that they can defend their homes. Maybe they have other reasons. Maybe they have an elderly person in their home and they can't easily evacuate, or they will evacuate, but they first have to decide, gosh, I can't go in the direction that I'm supposed to go because my kids are over in school on this other part of town. And so I don't know if it's, when we look at the research over the decades of disaster that preceded this sort of social media age, we would see these behaviors. And I don't always know if it's resistance to authority, but it's more about people having to localize their decisions based on what they see, what they know, and what their particular circumstances are. So they might completely respect the direction about what to do, but they might have some other immediate obstacles they have to solve before they can execute on that. And so when we look at past research, I think of the work of Sorensen and Sorensen, they show that people will always assemble a web of information. In this case, they weren't referring to the World Wide Web, but that's kind of a nice sort of connection to what we see today. People have always assembled a web of information that they glean from their family and friends. They glean it from everywhere, and they put this together and then decide how they're going to act. So what we see today is yet more places in which they could seek that information and assemble their sort of own local awareness and interpretation of what's going on. They have to match that outside view against the immediate things that they're facing.
I would think that one of the things that happens when you're faced with a disaster and everybody is suddenly tweeting and texting and doing their social media stuff with one another is that there would be the danger of a proliferation of misinformation and rumor, and that's part of what you have to deal with probably in much greater amount than you did before all these media.
This is another important topic, the matter of the veracity of information, the trustworthiness of the source. It's something we do have to worry about in the way that we worry about where all information comes from. What we see during kind of, I would say, the time closest to the event and by community members who are directly affected by the event is we see a very strong drive towards the system of people and the information that they're working with striving towards veracity. So it tends to be less about the judgment of one particular piece of information and more about the processes by which people decide something is valuable. So there's a great deal of self-policing online. We have evidence of different events.
What
where
do you mean, self-policing?
Self-policing. So people will check other people's claims about what they're saying. One might say that they could attribute a trustworthy behavior is one where somebody realizes, yes, I wasn't correct about that. Here's the corrected information. So people are policing each other. They're also policing themselves if they're a good source of information. If they're not a good source of information and they continually show that they're not correct, then they become ostracized because they're not demonstrating goodwill about striving to get the information correct. The thing about disaster response, really a mass emergency response, is that sometimes it's hard to know exactly what is the correct information. It's always imperfect. There isn't this sort of eye in the sky that tells us this is exactly right or wrong. So there can be information that turns out not to be exactly right, but it was as right as we knew at that particular point in time. The bigger issue, I think, around misinformation and the propagation of information that might not be appropriate might be that, for example, it's true for you in your neighborhood, but it's not true for me in my neighborhood. So that targeting of the audience, the mismatch between the speaker and the audience, might be more of the concern, rather than it's easier to find the deliberate pieces of misinformation. It's harder to detect, to know who the information is best for, because, right? Does that make sense?
Yeah, because if you have somebody on a hill and somebody in a valley in an earthquake zone, their needs and their experience are going to be really different.
Both are truthful, but you know, the information they might have access to is truthful, but it might not be appropriate for each of them, right? So that, I think, is the harder challenge when we talk about misinformation, rather than the outright, you know, signal that we're looking for, is it good, is it bad? The other issue would be information that's good at time zero may no longer be good at time two, time one or two.
And one or two might be 15 minutes.
Exactly, right. So those, I think, are the harder problems that we're wrestling with how to manage the information environment that we've got emerging in front of us.
So you have, I mean, there have been people responding to and studying, sociologists and journalists and everybody else, studying disasters for a really long time, and mm-hmm. disasters are part of the history of literature and drama and all of that, and that's all part of what you study. So then the next phase for you guys is, okay, what do we do about it? How do we help to create information systems for ordinary people mm-hmm. to tap into, so that if they are, for example, in an earthquake zone or a flood zone, that their chances of survival are better?
So there's a lot of things happening in both the research and the community of practice of both professional emergency management as well as sort of what I'll call citizen responders, those who are not officially employed as emergency managers, but maybe were in the past or have a lot of experience in emergency management as volunteers. So what we're seeing, there's a great deal of activity in this area. One of the ways to think about all this, you know, what we do with all this citizen reporting is, can we opportunistically use it to create, to help us flesh out our understanding of the situation, help us develop a better situational awareness of what's going on. This could be helpful to anybody, right? The authorities, people who are trying to make decisions. The idea is that it can be done in complement with all stakeholders in emergency response.
And I mean, you would think that would be kind of a no-brainer, because everybody, and we find this in the city of Santa Fe, neighborhood associations know their neighborhood so much better then the city council knows their neighborhood, and so they are really able to help make good decisions for their neighborhood. In a disaster, I would think that would be amplified.
Right. And so there are, but you know, when we're looking at, say, Hurricane Sandy, for which we've collected roughly 20 million tweets that appear to be about the hurricane, this is a lot of data coming down the pipe live, right? And so what the research and development right now is trying to do is trying to automatically parse and derive the critical pieces of information based sometimes on very sort of plain spoken English, actually as it's modified in a tweet, which can be really compressed down when it's down to 140 characters. So there's a lot of work in natural language processing and machine learning to see if we can derive that information, associate it with the location, associate it with other kinds of features of metadata that tell us this is good information, it's coming from this source, we need to listen to it, or even there's an absence of information over here, what does that mean? Are people in a good situation or are they in really a terrible situation? Then there's all these new skills and behaviors that are emerging as people get more practice at doing this. And one of the things I'll be talking about both at the Santa Fe Institute as well as tonight at the lecture is the rise of the digital, what's called the digital volunteer. These are people who have moved from disaster to disaster. They work completely virtually or nearly completely virtually, and they look for good information and then try to amplify it and consolidate it to be able to deliver it to you, to make it useful to you. So there's this human computation, there's this machine computation that might help us with information visualizations and maps. There are a community of people called crisis mappers who try to mark all this up on maps that are immediately consumable for people who are experiencing the disaster or who might want to help those who are experiencing disaster. We saw this to a great extent in response to Haiti, for example.
Right, right. We're talking to computer scientist Laysha Palin about how social media might help us survive the next big disaster. Now, you said earlier that a disaster is, I mean, I heard you to say a disaster is not defined just by, for example, the fact of a storm or earthquake or natural disaster or a fire, but the inadequacy of the response to that disaster. So it's as much a human phenomenon as it is a natural phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, so earthquakes, storms, weather-related events, volcanoes, these are all hazards, natural hazards. And so a hazard, when it interacts with a built environment, could become a disaster. Might not always, right? So an earthquake that affects San Francisco with good building codes, that magnitude of an earthquake at a certain depth might hopefully will cause less destruction than in an area where they don't have those building codes.
Like those earthquake-proof buildings.
Exactly.
That they build. Yeah.
Right. So a hazard, you have a hazard, and then it's an impact on the built environment determines to what degree we have what kind of emergency on our hands. And so when things become disastrous and catastrophic, it's usually, I mean, there's the personal effects of something being disastrous, and I would never take away a personal loss as being personally disastrous if you think about that in its psychological terms, but we think about it in its social terms, in terms of how our society is able to respond to it, how resilient a society is to it. That determines whether we're able to. That's based on capacities, whether we have the resources and the capacities to be able to respond to that particular event. And of course, some areas can be very well prepared, and disasters can be just so enormous that we don't have those capacities to get enough people to enough hospitals and those kinds of things.
Well, and I mean, if an earthquake and a fire happen together and houses burn, you can have all the capacity you want and you've got a bunch of burned down houses.
That's right.
Now, are people more altruistic? Do the best qualities of people come out during disasters?
It seems so when we, pre-ICT, pre-information and communication technology, when sociologists would look at behaviors of communities in the wake of a disaster event, they describe those communities as altruistic. And this is meant to especially be in response to this very easy inaccurate claim that people are panicking, that they're looding and acquiring all these terrible characteristics that they might not have had before. Communities immediately in the wake of the disaster tend to be very altruistic. People tend to help each other a lot. It's in their best interests to do this. When we try to think about that as it appears online, we have to be careful. I think when we look at some of the events that happened in 2006, 2007, where, say, the big wide world wasn't always involved online, didn't have a hand online in every disaster, we could say that we saw altruistic response. I think as we go on and on in time, I think we still have mostly, we have a system of people that's trying to drive information as resource towards truth, towards veracity, towards helpfulness. But you have to be careful because not everyone who responds is part of that geographical community anymore. They might have a different investment in that event. As time goes on, goes beyond that immediate hour, 2 hours, week, 2 weeks, you might then have to think about who the other actors might be who are involved. I think my hypothesis is that closer to the event, closer in the space-time of an event, you have greater altruism.
That's certainly what I heard from people during the Hurricane Sandy in New York. Somebody said for several days, everybody was really great to one another, and then they just turned back into New Yorkers again, in the negative sense of that word. And the people uptown who weren't affected didn't really have any use for the people downtown whose lights were out.
Yeah. But it's a behavior we do. We do see this kind of volunteer helpful behavior in response to events around the world. So even where there might be cultural differences in how people are oriented towards their neighbor, towards the other, towards volunteerism, it seems to suspend, whatever that might be, it seems to suspend itself in these immediate days following certain kinds of disaster events.
We're talking to computer scientist Laisha Palin.